You're listening to the Ink and Paint Folk Podcast, a look at animation through the women and non-binary folk who make it. I'm your host, Cassie Soliday. This week on the pod, it's all about the filmmakers behind the film, Tatina. And today's guest is director Kajsa Ness. Let me share a little about the film before we begin, in case you haven't seen it. It's based on the thrilling story of polar explorer Roald Amundsen and Italian engineer Umberto Nobile. Tatina tells a truish story of glory and defeat, seen through the eyes of the street dog that became the world's first four-legged celebrity who traveled to the North Pole in a Zeppelin. Sounds fun, right? It is. I love this movie. The film is hand-drawn in 2D. Oh, 2D. Interspersed with real-life footage. And it was produced in Norway and Belgium. So grab a beverage of your choice. Sketch while you listen if you like. And enjoy.
Hello, I'm Kajsa Ness. I'm a director of animated films from Oslo, Norway. And I have been making animation for more than 30 years now in a studio here in Oslo called Microfilm. And I recently made my first feature film called Tatina. Before that, mostly short films. There's lots of things that brings me joy in animation. I like to try to make up different, not techniques, but different styles every time. You have a lot of options in storytelling, and you get to work with really, really talented and nice people. That's very joyful for me.
So true. That's amazing. I didn't realize Tatina was your first feature. Yeah, it's incredible for a first. Like, wow.
Yeah. But I have been making short films before that. So maybe 12 or I don't remember now. And music videos. And I also made a lot of animation for, you know, for documentaries, especially. That's kind of a specialty I have. And I made commercials and lots of other stuff too.
Yeah. And even with documentaries, even though like the documentary has its own director, there's still a director of the animated sequences, which I thought was interesting. When I learned that, I was like, oh.
Yeah. You know, documentary people, they don't know anything about animation. They need us to show them all the nice thing you can do with animation in documentaries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So documentaries have a lot of talking heads. So like, what else could we do?
Yes. Yeah. And usually sometimes it's quite common that the documentary directors come and they want us to make something that they are not able to film. Or if it's a film that's about the subject that happened 100 years ago, they don't have any footage, or so we have to invent it. And then we always try to push them kind of to explore the emotional or metaphorical side to make the animation more interesting.
Oh, that's so neat. When did you first realize you wanted to work in animation and be a director? Like, what's your origin story?
I actually started with first wanted to do still photography, and then I found that I was not the best photographer, and also I found it a bit lonely in a way. You were always alone in the dark room, and you were out taking your photos. And then I kind of drifted into live action film. I had a lot of friends who were working in live action, and I came on as a production assistant, and then I went to film school, and there, I don't know how we were kind of introduced to animation there in film school. And I think this was a kind of a very nice period of stop motion animation with the Bolex brothers and Armin. And there was a lot of really, really nice, cool stop motion animation coming from England. And then I kind of fell in love with that, actually. And then we tried our exam films. My exam film from film school was my first ever attempt of stop motion animation. We made a pixelated film with some stop motion. And then we had a big success with that film. And it took me to animation school, and then we just continued making animation.
Cool. This kind of snowballs into a career.
Yes. Yeah, it was just because there was a lot of really, you know, there was a lot of music videos, a lot of cool stuff with stop motion animation at that time in the 90s.
Very cool. So like when you went to school for animation, did you kind of study all forms of animation?
Yes, that was all. I went to Volda College here in Norway. It was quite a young school, so they were kind of figuring out how to do it. But I never came from drawing. There's a lot of, especially in 2D animation, people come from drawing and from art school. I never did that. I'm not a very good drawer, actually. I can't really draw. So I started up with stop motion. And the first, so I did in my exam films, and then I continued to work then with stop motion for many years. And we did a lot of cutout animation and glass table. And we kind of worked in front of the camera a lot for many years. And then I kind of drifted into 2D animation. Slowly. I think it's because I admire it a lot. I think it's really beautiful. I like the style. I like the flatness. I like it. The storytelling that you can do. And especially, you know, the idea that that it's so fluid in a way, and that people are very, very open. The audience are always very open when they look at 2D animation, kind of everything. Mm-hmm. If it moves, it can become anything. And yeah, you can make all kinds of different styles. And so I kind of drifted into 2D.
Yeah, it's nice because you don't have to figure out how to build it in like tangible form. Yeah, you can draw anything. One thing that happens over here, and maybe it's like an international thing, you could let me know, where you know, if something's animated, the majority of the audiences think it's for kids. Does that happen over there? They're like, it's a genre, not a medium.
Yes, it's very common that you think that it's for kids. And also a lot of my short films that are not really for kids are always screened at, you know, children's film festivals. But they're not like adult films, or, you know, there's not kind of, it's just that the theme is kind of harder or more metaphoric or philosophical than you think that kids films should be. But kids are also open. Kids are more open than grown-ups, obviously. And but I think it's quite interesting, this discussion with the genre and not the because we tend also to go very easily to, especially in feature films, it's quite hard to try to finance and produce a feature film for grown-ups, animated feature film for grown-ups. And you have to admit that most of the feature films that are produced, they look like they're for children, and they have children as main characters. And so they are kind of for children. So it's this discussion we also, as a, you know, like the animation industry, has to push more animated features for grown-ups then. That's also our responsibility, I think.
Yeah. I agree. I really like how Japanese anime does it, because you have animated stories for all ages, you know, and different subject matter. Like, I want a romantic comedy animation so bad, you know, or a slice of life in like an adult way, you know. Yeah, I hope that we can like get there. And I feel like with streaming evolving, we're sort of getting that. So hopefully it's the beginning of something.
Yeah, some of it. We have some films, but they are kind of going very often straight to streaming. Or that it's really hard to get these films, like, for instance, in the cinema in the States, for instance. It's almost impossible. So it's because we produce quite a lot of them here in Europe and also in Asia, but they don't really come to the rest of the audience. It's hard to get them out there. I think that
why is it so hard? Like, why is it so difficult to get films into the American theaters?
Oh, I think it's also because it's difficult to get people to go to the cinema. It used to be easier. It's like the America is really hard at the moment. It's the cinemas, you know, or the distributors are afraid of taking risks. And it's So I know that it's been much harder now than it used to be, actually, also for indie films. And also this is also for live action, actually.
Yeah, that makes sense. I know that I feel like I've seen it where there'll be like a special event with a foreign film or animated film, and it's like a series to get them into the theater. So it's like prompted more as a special event thing. So I was thinking like, because I was, you know, working on this short film, like probably like 7 years ago now. And we were doing a lot of looking into film festivals and like, what do you have to do to be eligible to be nominated for an Oscar for that, for the short film category. And one thing is that you have to show the film within the LA area or New York area to be considered. Yeah. So is that something you all have done with Tatina? Will it be up for?
We had some screenings. We did have some screenings in LA. We were there for the Animationist Film Festival, you know, and then we also have some screenings now in August, I think, in LA. And I think we're going to have some, maybe some more screenings. I'm not sure. So that's to be eligible for the Oscars. Yeah,
that's cool. So like submitting it to the film festivals is part of it, like within those cities.
Yeah, for short films, there are certain festivals that are kind of eligible for Oscars. And then if you win a prize in one of these festivals, you are automatically eligible. So there's a lot for short films, but the feature films are not so many. So that's much more
involved.
Then it's worth it to go to LA and have the screenings and
Very cool. Well, I wish you luck on that. I hope that works out because like, not only is it like a symbol for all the effort you and the team put into a project, it's also how more people see it. Like, you know, every year I watch all the Oscar nominated, like animated films and short films and see things that I wouldn't normally see in my path, like on a normal day. Like, I should go deeper into it, of course, but like for the mainstream audience who doesn't see animation as much, they might actually see it, you know? I do feel like these paths are important. So it's cool that like, you know, we could put that in people's heads if they make a short film, like you made it, people should be able to see it. So it's worth it.
And there's a lot of really nice animation festivals where you can send your short film. So that's
what would be your top three recommendations for short film festivals?
Short films. Yeah, I would definitely try to go to Annecy, of course, if you come into Annecy, but it's quite hard. They have thousands and thousands of films.
That's the big one. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you have also Brussels, have the Anima Brussels, which is a really nice festival, I think. It's so fun and friendly. And there's recently now been in Fantoche in Basel in Switzerland, which is also really nice. Yeah, that was the first three that came to mind. They were all in Europe, of course. I don't know. I haven't been to too many festivals in the States. I've been to Tribeca, and that's really nice. I've screened short films at Tribeca. That was a lot of fun.
Nice.
And maybe in Portland, they also have some really nice festivals.
Do you find that you end up networking at the festivals? Like, has that helped expand just your network of people in animation?
Yeah, you always do, I think, when you travel. And what's nice with the animation industry is that you travel to festivals and you end up having dinner with your, you know, your biggest heroes or the guy who won Oscar last year. It's just a really, really nice community. And it's quite small and we all kind of travel to the same places. So you kind of end up getting friends and you meet them every time you go to these festivals, which are really, really nice. Some festivals are more kind of relaxed and fun than others. And like, for instance, Annecy, where there's a really, really big market, you do a lot of networking. And then you are kind of in the loop in a way, and then you get to travel a lot. And then some films, they don't really travel so much. You can never really know why. It's depending on what's cool this year or if you manage to do something that you... you never know. You can never know. It's always a surprise, I think. Yeah, if people like it or not, it's impossible to plan or...
Yeah, like doing that much travel must get expensive. Do you kind of wrap that expense into the budget of the overall film? Because it is publicity, you know, like it should be part of it.
If you get invited to the main competition, usually the festival pays for your ticket and for your hotel. And then you can kind of tend, in Norway, we have funds that you can apply for if you want to promote your film. And then you get, depending on the festival, you get some money to go to the festival. So you can kind of get scholarships or funding. If you have a small studio, sometimes the studio pays a little bit and yeah.
So you made all these short films and you got the opportunity to do a feature. Can you talk about that transition?
Yes, I always used to say that, you know, if you're going to make a feature, it's going to have to be a really, really good story because it takes such a long time to make a feature. So for me, that was when I came across the story of Titina, that was the first time I actually were interested in doing a feature, actually, because I found the story very kind of moving and interesting. And it was also fun to think of how you can make this story, you know, not into this heroic polar hero epic story, but something different that says something about us today. So it was kind of slowly coming into this idea. And then, of course, because we have a different system here than in funding films, it took a long time to get all the funding since this was my first feature. So it was kind of slowly growing into the feature department. So yeah, I was even making a short film while we were financing Titina. So
like, how do you stay optimistic when you keep having to wait and like try and try again?
Yeah, because it's not like you have to try again, because we kind of got yes all the time, but you get kind of a small amount of money to make for like a treatment, and then you get a small amount of money to make first version of the script, and then you get this so you kind of slowly build it little by little like this, and then when you have all this, you kind of apply for all the production money, and then it was quite fast. Because then we had worked for years preparing these applications, and you know, we had done a lot of networking on the sea, for instance. Mm. So, but it's kind of also fun and interesting, and it doesn't mean that you do the same over and over again, because you have to kind of work with it, and you have to kind of maybe this doesn't work, let's try this, could we try these kind of designs instead of these. So it's always something new anyway.
Yeah.
I do wish we could have like a big studio with all those money they have in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Have like a team say, let's see, what are we going to do today? We're going to make this film. It could be about this. Oh, maybe about that. That sounds really nice.
That does sound really nice. So I did have a project with one of the bigger studios over here, and they didn't pay as well as I thought. So,
no.
But maybe for people who have a lot more experience than I do, maybe they would, you know, would pay them better. But that sounds like a dream to have that those kind of resources.
I don't think I would get into the animation business to become rich. Then you should do
don't do it.
Yeah.
A lot of people, for instance, think that like animation writers are in WGA, and like some of them are, because there are some adult animated shows that are in WGA. But we don't make near that much money.
No.
Like, yeah, we're here because we love it. So with the idea for Titina, like, how did you first come across it?
It was kind of a coincidence, or a little bit by chance, because I was looking for a Christmas present for my mother's new husband. And I didn't know him very well. And I was like, okay, let's find a present for him. And then I found the book about Umberto Nobile. And I knew that he was very fond of Italy and he likes history. So I kind of started looking into this book. And then I came across this story, and I realized I'd never heard about this before. You know, Roald Amundsen is one of the most famous Norwegians ever. We all know his name or what he did, that he went to the South Pole and the Northwest Passage, and he was kind of the greatest Norwegian hero ever. And then here's this story about him traveling around in an airship. And why have I never heard about this? And that's why I got really interested. And then, of course, I looked into the story and understood the tragedy in it. And you can also see kind of the humor in it a little bit. Like, you know, in Norway, we know that if you're going to go to the North Pole and you bring dogs, you have to bring dogs that can work or can save you. And sometimes, even if you are in real danger, you might have to eat them. That's how it is to survive. And then Umberto Nobile comes with this tiny lapdog and brings her to the North Pole, which is, to me, really, really strange. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really humorous and it's charming. Like, I love the film so much. And when I first like read the summary, I was like, well, that's wild and charming. And then watch it. And then you see the documentary footage and like, what? This is like real?
Yeah.
So it's really cool. Also that, you know, you have the animation interspersed with the documentary footage. And so like you have it influenced, you have that influencing the story and everything, but you took a lot of creative liberties along the way, of course, for storytelling and entertainment value. And talking about that, when did you stray from reality? And when did you infuse like magical realism?
We wanted to tell this story in a different kind of, from a different perspective. I am really, really fond of, you know, filmmakers like Jacques Tati or Wes Anderson or, that you have this kind of strangeness in human characters. I really, really enjoy that. I wanted to bring this into this film about these kind of classical male characters, to kind of make them more childish and, you know, more human in a way, which I think is nice and fun, and also to show the kind of the big system around them working. Like, we all kind of exist in a, you know, a big system. We have to behave in a certain way. We all try to exist in this system. And then to try to find, to show the humor in this system, that would be kind of things I wanted to do. And then you get the liberty to kind of go out from the kind of the classical storytelling and the classical ways of presenting these kind of stories. And then you are kind of free. You are open and free. You can do it. And that's also what's nice with animation. You can do this, and people or the audience kind of come along because it's animation. They say, yes, let's go there. Let's have some nice dancing penguins here. That sounds good. So I think it's this idea that you wanted to open up the storytelling. And also the fact that we try to tell it from Titina's point of view and to give her a kind of her own story, that kind of also opened up for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love what you're saying, because I hadn't thought about them operating within a system, because like that makes me realize how, you know, Amundsen and Nobile like both had their own expectations and they didn't connect, you know, but when they're outside of, you know, society expectations and presenting like this accomplishment to others, like they had this really great, warm, childlike, like you said, relationship. Over here we'd call it kind of like a bromance. It was really sweet. You had like the telephone and like something's happening here. And it's just really lovely. With Titina and having the story through her point of view, what I really enjoy about, well, I enjoy so many things, I'll keep saying, but like, I love that you didn't feel forced to have Titina speak. Like, she's a real dog and she's a very small dog. And so there's a lot of compositions that are lower in on the screen, right? Looking up at people. And like, there's a lot of dog moments. Although like when she goes to these like fantasy sequences, the adults don't see that. It's just Titina. Like animation so great in those moments. It feels like, you know, looking through the timeline of this adventure, like there'd be a lot of different opportunities to focus on. What was the storyboarding and like writing process like to figure out what to present on screen to deliver the story to the audience?
Because when we started to do, I worked with the scriptwriter, Per Skreiner, and he has never written animation before. This was his first animated film.
Wow.
But of course we had the kind of the storyline of the story, the true storyline of the, So we were trying to, if you look at it, it's kind of problematic. First they go to the North Pole and then they go back, then they go up to the North Pole again, and then something dramatic happened. You have to kind of try to make that feel, you know, not too kind of constructed or too
convoluted.
And then we decided to write a script without dialogue, Completely. So we kind of described all the things and that and put the characters there and tried to make it kind of work without dialogue, which it did, of course, in the script. It worked really nice without dialogue. And then we realized later in the storyboard, we had to have some dialogue to kind of set up the situations. So that came later, actually. So this
is interesting.
Kind of developing a little bit through the storyboard period. But then we knew, of course, I worked with the Divica Schöll that you have also talked to, that we knew that we had a lot of references, like fun references and, you know, also kind of references for the cinematography. I worked with a cinematographer and we made kind of rules for cinematography. And then we knew that we were going to solve some of the scenes kind of, you know, more fun and more loose and more lively, which were kind of the scenes in Rome where nobody was at home, where they kind of were at ease. And then because this was kind of the nice and, you know, floaty, where they were relaxed, the characters. And then when we got to the kind of, you know, the official parts, it could be flatter and stiffer and not so much camera movements or not so much editing. We kind of had all these kind of thoughts. And then I worked with the storyboard department and gave them kind of scripts and notes. And we were kind of deciding, like, for instance, take the phone call that first that was written in the script. It was written that we could only see Roald Amundsen calling. And then we just heard his kind of, I want an airship. It should be big. It has to be. But then we decided to bring in also Nobler to see his reactions. And then we kind of made this little dance. And this turned out to be their first meeting then. They don't even meet, but we can see them both. So this was kind of developing slowly into something that could work for animation and also for the storytelling. It's a really nice storyboarded scene, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. It's my favorite scene. Yes. It's so cool to hear about this evolution, having these rules, things you mentioned, I did not even notice watching it, which is highest praise because no one should know that that's a rule, right, when they're watching it. So it's really interesting, these hidden things that directors do with their team to set up the style of how the film and storytelling will go. I want to ask more questions about this because, like, it changes every film.
It's very, it depends on the story and your characters that always, it will change.
That's so incredible. And it's very clear that you allow space for your team to explore and do what they do well, right? So, like, along your path, how has it been, like, developing your skills as a director? Were there any, like, pivotal moments or obstacles you faced that kind of helped define the way you direct?
Yeah, I think because you always go into a project and think that you're going to be kind of, maybe I'm going to do some animation, maybe I can do some editing, maybe I can kind of be hands-on, but you always end up kind of, you just have to do a lot of kind of explanation and talking and here also writing, you know, emails and giving notes and planning things a lot. I think maybe next time I will be even more prepared for also for the animation period. Every shot, every scene, we need to kind of know what's happening. Yeah, in every, I think I would be, because now I was a little bit behind all the time, but to be even, really, really prepared and also be really, really connected to, you know, the head of departments, like with the animation director, for instance. We took some time to kind of get in sync. She lives in Brussels. I never worked with her before. And then we had to kind of get to trust each other. But the moment from when we found that trust, it was working really, really well. And then I can relax more because I know that they also know what I want to. And we kind of get into this kind of same pace in a way. It's it's really fun when you manage to do that with your head of departments. Yeah, I don't know. Did I answer your question now, really?
Yeah. I have a follow-up. How do you gain someone's trust exactly?
Yeah, you have to give them also the freedom to explore a little bit then. You have to try to figure out what is their way of working and what can they actually add to your work. What can, because it's always I am really, really dependent on their kind of abilities and their kind of talent. And but if you give them the possibility to attend or to kind of participate in the making of the film, it will be more fun and they will trust you more and they will come with wonderful stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe during the Women in Animation panel that you were on, your producer had mentioned that Microfilm, you know, seeks out auteur directors, right? So can you talk about that? Because like we don't really have that here. And, you know, live action does, like Wes Anderson yeah. and stuff. So I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, we are four girls or four women running Microfilm. And it was Lisa, the other producer, and I, we started it then 27 years ago or something like that. Wow. We made our first film together in film school. That was, that's where we made our first film. And we came, maybe it's because we came from live action that we have this kind of idea with us, that because what we do, we are not a studio that kind of makes whatever you, if you come to our studio and say, we want this and this and this. Maybe we can't make it because we are a studio that are made up of mostly of directors. And we used to say that we are a director driven studio because we think that the projects or the films we make or produce, they need to come from a director, not from a producer. because we want them to be kind of different and run and important for the director, and that is the director who comes with the idea and the project. Usually they are also animators, and that's how we kind of run the whole studio. Yeah. I think it's also because we have producers that like to be kind of creatively involved in all the projects they do. We don't kind of just push things through our studio. That's not how we work. Makes it more fun.
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah. And you have more ownership over it, yes, I would think, as yeah. well.
Probably also different in Europe than it is in the States, because we have like cultural funding for film and short films. So we kind of run our studio on this funding. For instance, it's quite difficult to produce a TV show here in Norway because it's quite expensive to produce. But we also have, of course, the love for film and short films and animated documentaries, and that's what we like mostly. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that you and your you guys are friends, I would assume, yes, by now. Friends. Like you and your friends.
You can call us friends.
Okay. I don't want to take away from the business aspect because you guys are co-workers, but also friends and collaborators. But it's like so beautiful that you built this career in the studio together from such a young age, from college, and you're getting to see your visions through and take turns producing each other's, you know, stories that you really want to tell. And I think that's so special. Anyways.
Yeah, I think we've been, let's say, lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. Hard work meets luck, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Do you have like, are you like stirring on any new feature ideas or short ideas?
Yeah, I'm just starting to think about a new feature. Yeah. So we'll see if it's possible to fund it. But we'll see. Yeah. I'm not gonna lie, it's probably gonna be expensive.
Well, now that you have one in the can, that'll probably help get it funded.
Yeah, let's hope that will be that will help. Yeah, but I still want to be, you know, I really admire, you know, storytelling. And this is maybe because we came from Scandinavia. We have this kind of storytelling that is quite close to fairy tales and to kind of old, it's kind of quite serious. It's always kind of metaphoric. And we have also like Moomin and Astrid Lindgren, you know, famous Scandinavian literature. Which has this kind of hardness in it. And I really would like to make, films for children like that, that has this kind of, that can be, you know, told for grown-ups, but also be kind of for children, but still with a seriousness in it, but still fun, and you know, but not all kind of fun and happy, jumpy all the time. But you know, yeah. So like an adventure or a fairy tale like that, that would be my next project.
I can't wait. There's a lot of people out there listening that, you know, either know they want to be a director or they've thought about it. So like, what would your advice be to those people? Like, how would you get started, like developing your artistic directorial style?
I think you just have to study a lot of art, just enjoy art and all kinds of, you know, games, but also very important, also live action films. I think you should not only look at animation. I think you should expand your kind of library of histories with and how histories are told, and look at live action films from all over the world, actually, from Asia and Africa and South America, and and also old films from the 1920s, and because there's such a nice library and so many nice kind of ways of telling your story. Yeah, always observe, I think. Always be open for things, but not only in animation. I think that's quite important, actually. It will make your life kind of a little bit more open if you step a little bit outside of animation. Not everything has to be a kind of a jumpy joke. And maybe also one piece of advice is also to be outside a bit. Go outside, go in the mountains, go look at the sea, or I think that's also nice.
Definitely
good place, or put yourself in places where you, like, for instance, take the bus, where you don't look at things or read things, you just sit there, and then all of a sudden you have an idea. The ideas never come when you sit down and think, I'm going to make something. That's a terrible idea. You have to go out. You have to do something else. Go on a run. I don't know. Cook food, something you like. And then your head kind of stops working, and then something happens.
Yeah. And that's an interesting point, because like productivity advice tells us that we shouldn't wait for like inspiration to strike. We should show up at our desk and work like regularly. But like, that's also a different type of work. You know, I feel like that's not when you're like gathering the idea or actively looking to like expand on what something means or nurture. It's like, that's when you are executing, right? You need to show up, even if you can't write like a whole page, like write half a page or write for 30 minutes, you know, because like, even if you don't feel like, you know, directing on a day, you show up, right? But when you're in those early stages of recovering.
You cannot do that during direction, that you, I have to go and just take the bus. But you just have to make these rooms always also during directing period. You are kind of very pressured because things have always have to happen fast. But of course, this is for pre-production or early production, but you have to kind of make these rooms. Like, for instance, instead of driving, maybe walk to the studio. It's really that easy.
That's
for me. Of course, this is different for every person, but for me, showing up at your desk every day, trying to be creative, that doesn't really work for me. But of course, when you are in production, you have to be there, and then you have to do it because people are waiting for you. But then you have had all this time before preparing for that. So,
Right. Yeah. It's different lanes. So I just wanted to like put that out there too, because it's interesting to think about like the upper creative, like above the line, because it's so different than below the line, like the people who are like producing, doing the art and everything. And like, they need to take care of their creative well as well. You know, they could walk to work and like get inspiration for something specific they're working on. But just having that like big overview and like having to feel inspired yourself and be on message and on your themes that you want to deliver, but also be able to like inspire your crew. How do you manage both your emotional place when you're on a production as well as motivating and inspiring your team?
I think it's also that you have to kind of I spend a lot of time and energy in the beginning when I meet my team to try to kind of make them think like me, or to try to explain what I'm thinking about. And I show them lots of references, both in the, you know, art or kind of scenes from films I like, or things I found on YouTube or whatever. Yeah, you, things that you think are important for your film, and you have to kind of make books for them, or things that they can open up and see, or you have to make a big wall with lots of pictures so they kind of come into the studio and they are in this kind of your inside your head all the time. So this is very important in the beginning of the production. But then when they start to work and they bring their stuff in, then we can always come back to this moment where you remember in the beginning we talked about this, or no, that's not how I like it, because you remember I like this style from this film, and we look at that. And so you kind of, you have to do all that work in the beginning, and then hopefully they will be creative with you on the same kind of place. They will be in the same place as me, during their the rest of the production.
Yeah. That's incredible. Yeah.
Sometimes it's, with Titina, we had a very small group of animators coming in the beginning, and we kind of really had to work hard with them. And then all of a sudden it kind of clicked, and then it all went really nice.
That's good. And I don't think we covered it earlier. Like, you guys actually produced most of it during the pandemic. Did you, were you working remotely? Cause like, did it click before everyone had to work from home?
We decided that we kept the, because we did, we used, you know, for posing, and then the same team for posing, and for, and then most of the posing artists went on to do animation. Mm-hmm. And then we decided to have posing and animation in the studio. So, but I had to live in Belgium. I went to Belgium. I left my family here in Oslo. They were supposed to come with me, but because of COVID, they had to stay here. So I lived in Belgium for 1.5 years. So we managed to keep, we had two studios, one in Ghent and one in Brussels. So that's just 30 minutes with the train. And then we managed to keep them in the studio all the time. And I think that was kind of, that's my most important wish or rule or whatever you could call it, is that to keep the teams together and work together face to face. I think it's much easier for me. If I wouldn't do that, I would have to sit and write emails or notes in Shotgun all day, which is so annoying. And instead of just walking over to a person, looking at something and see, no, I think you have to remove those two frames and maybe we can kind of turn the head a little bit faster and then he can blink. That took me, I don't know, 5 seconds to say that, instead of kind of having this kind of going back and forth and back and forth and so many misunderstandings on emails. Yeah. So for me, I'm very happy we managed to keep the animators in the studio. The art departments had to stay at home. But that's easier because then we could meet once a week and go through all the things together. And then they went home and worked. So that was easier, less drawings. So, I really don't like the remote work. I think it's nice for people who like to stay home, of course, and also for producers, because they don't need to facilitate, you know, a nice workplace. Or it's nice for some producers, I think. But for directors, it's, I don't think it's nice.
Yeah, definitely miss out on you know, those check-ins and socializing.
Yeah, like, if you want to kind of be, like I said, I need to get the people to be in my head. And that's so much easier when you meet and are together. You can go out for coffee or let's have an ice cream or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, for sure. Let's have our meeting over ice cream is my favorite phrase.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. This has been amazing. Like, as we wrap up here, like, do you have any last words for the audience?
I think that we need to kind of believe in our creativity and to that we are able to set a mark on things, and that you are needed to make really nice stuff. I'm so old. I've been through a lot of these crises, you know. We will never go to the film again, because the cinema again, because now we have video and you know, all these things, and now everything has to be 3D with 3D glasses. It never happened. And what about VR? I don't know how many rounds we had. Like, now everything is going to be VR. And we're all going to have these really big goggles and really heavy goggles on our face. Are we going to look at everything and cinema's dying? But I don't think it will. And I don't think that the studios... yeah, maybe some films will be made with AI. I don't know. But I think there's also lots of stuff that won't be made with AI. We need, you know, human heads and hearts and hands.
Well, again, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been amazing. Yeah, I love talking to you. So thank you so much.
It was very nice. And thanks for doing this, Cassie. It's really nice.
Of course.
Ink and Paint Folk is produced in partnership with Women in Animation, an organization dedicated to advancing women in the field of animation and reaching 50-50 by the year 2025. Learn more about womeninanimation.org. This episode was produced by me, Cassie Soliday, with the magic of the internet. Music by Dominique Parker. Edited by Daniel Wachorik. All opinions expressed here are our own and do not represent those of our respective employers. Until next time, this has been the Ink and Paint Folk podcast. Stay colorful.